This podcast is brought to you by PrideNZ.com with generous support from the Rural Foundation.
I was born in 1931 in Otago and spent all my life in Otago until I finished university in 52. And then went to Auckland for teacher training and more or less have and stayed there for quite a while teaching, then moved around the country in various places, fielding, then back to Dunedin again, and then after marriage moving to other places.
Growing up in the 1930s and the 1940s, were you aware of kind of homosexuals?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Looking back, I can see it, but no. Nothing.
So, looking back, what can you see?
I'd see my interests were certainly not with girls. I very seldom went out with a girl, only if I had an occasion which demanded a partner. And I just put that down to shyness. I didn't know how to manage that, and so on.
Was it ever talked about, like in the family? Or
it was never talked about anywhere. No, it was completely not a forbidden subject. It was just not a subject at all.
It just didn't happen.
No. And of course, it was going on, but most of us didn't know. In fact, I would say that 95% of the population didn't know.
So when did you know within yourself that something might be up?
Probably not until I was in my 30s. After I was married. I had no consciousness of it until then.
And what happened?
Oh, just gradually I realised that I was in the wrong place and not unhappy, but it wasn't quite the place I expected it to be, and just developed gradually from there, and a little bit of exploration here and there, and until I realised what was what.
Did you feel, when you started having those feelings, did you feel kind of like torn? Was this something that you kind of reacted against? Or?
Yes, I guess it was the same sort of feelings that young guys have when they start masturbation and believe that it's evil. Those same sorts of feelings. The moment of pleasure was great, but the guilt afterwards, yeah. Mm.
Because you had been quite a bit of your life up until that point had been quite involved in the church, yeah?
Well, only from late teenage years, yes. Mm. And then on to when I went into the ministry.
Mm. Tell me about that.
Oh, that just sort of developed as I got involved with youth work in the church as a member of youth groups and so forth. Gradually that's where it went, and I decided that's where I wanted to go.
So for you, did you ever feel conflicted, or was it just a natural kind of progression of finding out who you were?
Well, it was both. It was both, yeah. It was a natural progression, plus there were conflicts. After all, being in the ministry of the church and being married and being a parent and so forth and so on, and having been a secondary teacher as well, all those things were contra to where I was going.
Can you describe for me what it was like having all of that, like, you know, a wife and family and the church, and then also on the other hand thinking that you may be gay?
Well, it was possible to keep the two separate, but more and more I resented the church for its attitude, and I spoke quite openly about the church's attitude, even though I wasn't out or anything, both in the parish and in the National Assembly of the Church, in the presbytery and so forth. And it was the time of the homosexual law reform then, which was for several years before that. Of course, it was a hot topic in the church. Yeah. My marriage, we managed it in the marriage, as far as our relationship was concerned. I mean, the relationship was a good relationship.
So it was actually talked about?
In my relationship. Mm. For a while, when it first manifested itself, and when I fell in love with someone, yes, but after that, it was agreed we wouldn't discuss it. That was out of concern for my wife. Mm.
Can you describe what it was like kind of living those two kind of lives?
Mm. There's always a fear of being discovered. There was always a fear of transmission of sexual infections. Those were the two major fears. And they were fears rather than guilt. I didn't feel terribly guilty about any of that. I'd long before that resolved the biblical questions in my favour, which I still believe are the right interpretations, and they were supported by through my theological training. Professors also taught that those comments in the Bible were misinterpreted, and they were interpreted against today's background instead of against the background of the day, and that there are very different reasons for the prohibitions in biblical times, and they weren't moral reasons, they were national survival reasons. Israel just had to keep up their birth rate, and otherwise they wouldn't survive. So that was the reason behind their reasoning.
A lot of the history that's been told or that you can access is about people that were kind of out, things like gay liberation in the 60s and 70s, mm. You know, that you can actually, people were happy to be out and they were very political, but I'm guessing there was a whole lot of stuff happening that is a lot quieter.
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, the public face... There are two public faces, I think. There was the, what you might call the flamboyant... either flamboyant men or flamboyant queens, drag queens. There's that side. But there's also the side of those who are working seriously for change, led by, you know, such people here in Auckland as Tony Katovich and Brett Shepherd and all those people. Now, they were before my time of involvement at all. And although I knew both of them very well, it was after all the turmoil had been gone through.
Can you paint a picture of... from your own point of view, of what perhaps the 60s, 70s were like in terms of being a gay man that wasn't necessarily kind of out?
Well, I think for most, the only avenue of activity that seemed to be available was what the British call cottaging. And one or two, I'm just not sure when West Side began, beginning of the sauna thing. Backstage, of course, it was back there as well. Not that I knew anything about it. I'd heard about it and that's all. I never went there or anything. I really had absolutely no involvement with the community until the HIV issues.
And when you say cottaging, is that that's kind of the toilet bog scene?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the only place to go to meet, that you had any chance of meeting like people. how would you know where else to go? Those who had been out fully to themselves and so forth earlier, they formed groups, small groups, and a lot of them were sort of dinner party groups and those sorts of things, and lots of well-known people belonged to those, yeah. But I didn't discover those until much later.
At that time, what kind of language was around gayness? You know, what kind of words were being used to describe somebody who's gay?
I never came across that because, apart from a few general ones at school and those sorts of things, and faggot, and even homo wasn't used. Queer, no, that was used a little bit, but I think faggot was the main one that was used. But, you know, memory dims.
And being used in probably not a pleasant way?
Oh, no, not at all. And, of course, it depends what circles you're in. I mean, some circles you can use that with each other and nobody's offended. You know that it's And I was watching a television thing last night about racism and the British police force, and a black woman policeman being charged with racism because she said to one of her black colleagues, "Come on, hurry up, you lazy nigger," and that they sort of knew each other, that it was just a sort of a chivvying along, and somebody reported it as serious. And, yeah. So it was that sort of thing. And so I guess I avoided a lot of that, yeah. And yet, just thinking now, in my teaching, because I was teaching in the area of sexuality, I'm just beginning to think when I started that. That must have been the late 80s, I think. Oh, no, it was at the time of the HIV thing, yes. Mm. And so we explored a lot of that stuff in class, and that's where most of it sort of came from. The kids, because of the way I taught, they brought that sort of stuff up and we put it up and then we explored it and its meaning and so forth.
And when you say teaching, is that what, secondary school? Or?
Mm. Yeah, third and fourth form. Mm.
Back in the 70s, did you find that your thoughts were in conflict with church teachings?
Yes, but not biblical teachings. And the two are really quite separate. And more I withdrew from Christian belief. That I felt that a huge amount of it was rubbish. The theology particularly, and church politics and so forth. Biblical things, no. I've always held that the Bible is an amazing book, and yeah, and interpreted openly, it's got a lot to say. But I gradually was beginning to reject the church. In fact, all organized religion altogether. Still, and reject it completely and utterly today. Greatest evil the world has ever known. It's responsible for more human suffering, I think, than anything else in the world. And it doesn't matter whether it's Christian or Muslim or Buddhist or anything else, or all the pagan religions of Africa. They're all the same. They're all about power.
Wasn't there a point, though, in the 70s, I must have read somewhere, where weren't you in a church-type workshop and you suddenly kind of had quite a discovery?
I don't know about I had a discovery, but I was able to announce that discovery. Yeah. And that was... but that was part of the encounter movement, which came into New Zealand from America through the church. And I think the Anglican church started, and then it came into the other churches. And we there was a big group of us who were very active in it. And we started in workshops, and then we began to develop workshops of our own and so forth. And that was hugely liberating. And to me, that was the real church.
Can you tell me about that experience, that workshop?
Just that one of the things in those workshops were to design exercises which would help people to communicate, to open themselves to other people, to take risk. And one of the guys who trained with me in the theology, he designed this one called the pyramid. And it was, not quite sure when it was, but it was in the time of the debate about homosexual law reform. In fact, it might have been after that. Because the question he asked was what people's attitudes were and participation was in that development. And he built up layers in this pyramid. Of course, I didn't do any of them until there was only one place at the top. And so that's where I placed myself and was able to say. And the support I received from every single one in that group was just amazing. Even though some of them were quite conservative Christians. But they were all exploring Christians, and that was the big thing.
So was that the first time you had kind of publicly kind of come out?
I think it probably was. Can't think of any earlier time. And I guess I came out because the ethos of that group was that what happens in the group stays in the group. So I felt safe enough to do that.
And did that happen? Did it stay in the group?
As far as I know, yes. Certainly there were no repercussions from it.
And how did you feel after doing that?
It was very liberating, yeah. To begin with, a few fears that it might go elsewhere, although I don't know if they even worried about that at that point. I think probably I felt so completely safe and nurtured that... Because two or three of the guys came to me afterwards and were talking, and they were those straight guys, and they were expressing their support and and wanted to know more about what it was all about and so forth. It was quite an experience.
You left the church in 1976?
76, yeah.
Why was that?
I no longer believed. And I was very angry about the church's attitude to the homosexual law reform or to the whole that whole movement of developing that was developing. And that the Presbyterian Church was going backwards in terms of openness. It was retreating all the way and left a lot of us stranded on the shores, as it were. We just couldn't participate in that and just walked out.
Did you fill yourself with any other kind of spirituality or religion?
No. One of the views I have of religion is that it's a crutch for people who are not whole or not well. Once you become whole, you don't need the crutches. Throw them away. And so that whole process of knowing who I was actually becoming whole. I no longer needed it. And found it was a hindrance to being whole.
You mentioned just before about HIV and AIDS, and I'm just wondering, when was the first time you heard of AIDS?
Must have been the very, very early 80s. Just general news, I think, or maybe read about it in Time or something like that. And of course it immediately resonated with me as concerning me. And so I guess I was also looking for some way of becoming part of who I was, wanting to be involved in something and to meet others like me, and this was one way of doing it. So there was some self-interest in that side, but also concern on the other side about what was happening.
So what was being established in New Zealand? When you say you wanted to be a part of what?
Well, I think, I'm trying to think now, I think it was probably Ray Taylor when he came back from America and set up the shanty system. And I think they were calling for volunteers and people to help train volunteers. And I felt that with my inner self and with the expertise I had, then that was something I might be able to do. And that was a thing, but I just can't quite remember exactly how it happened.
Can you just explain what the shanty system is?
It was set up in San Francisco as a support system for people with HIV, and based on buddying. A person trained in buddying would be buddied up with someone who was HIV positive. And we trained quite a lot of people here in Auckland in that. But, of course, a lot of them got lost energy because there was no one to buddy. There weren't, that time, there were very, very few cases. And most of them were guys who came back from overseas. And so it took quite some time, and I think we probably lost 50% of the people we trained because there's just nothing to hold them.
So the kind of shanty principles became incorporated into this is the AIDS support network?
Yes, yeah.
And so that's Ray Taylor and Bruce Burnett?
Yes.
Can you describe for me what it was like being a part of a new group, a support group, where you may have, gay people and also the straight allies?
Well, that was part of the reason, of course, why I went there, because it was a group of other gay people. To begin with, almost all gay men, then a few straight women particularly came in, not many lesbians, very few in fact, at that stage, and so that's, I guess that was the driving force for me, because this was an opportunity to get into something that had some standing, wasn't just sex, opportunity to meet a lot of other gay people in a normal, natural way, which I'd never had before. So that was a motivating factor. And I was supported in that by my wife. She was very supportive of that. And she became part of it as well.
Can you describe for me what one of those meetings was like?
The training meetings. It was interesting to me too, because it was part of the Encounter movement. It came out of the Encounter movement. So it was the same sort of setup which I was used to in our groups, our church groups, where people were able to open, they're able to challenge each other without being upset or too upset. And some of the things that were revealed by individuals in those groups were just unbelievable. And they'd never, ever told anyone else about them, ever. They were quite, they were very emotional, very warming, very supportive, very positivizing, and it meant that they were able to deal with their own fears, and therefore were able to go and support other people's in their fears.
And were you saying that your wife is also part of?
Yes, that? she trained in one of those groups, one of our biggest ones. We had about 40 members in that particular group. So, including a nun.
So what was it like for you being in that group with your wife, talking about these kind of things?
It was fine, because, we were always pretty communicative anyway. But in her, one of the things, starting point in those meetings, because they usually began with a weekend, and the starting point was what was called the circle. And everybody went round and introduced themselves and said why they were there and so forth and so on. And that would be, some of that would be just unbelievably deep. And there'd be lots of tears and lots of laughter. It was, yeah. And remember that particular group, we took the whole of the first day just doing the circle, because it was so big and there were so many. And there were several guys in that who revealed for the first time that they were HIV positive. They never revealed to anybody else, not even their, I don't think some of them, not even the medical system, but they knew they were.
At the time, was there a test for HIV?
I don't think so. Or if it was, it was very complicated, and it wasn't done in New Zealand. Anything had to be sent to Sydney to be done.
What was the life expectancy at that time of somebody with AIDS?
Well, it varied, and it depends where they contracted the virus, because there were different modifications of the virus, and some were very virulent. The Sydney one, for instance, I mean, guys could die in 6 weeks from infection, from the first infection, and whereas others, it was a much slower process. And depended also on the individual's immune system and so on. So it varied greatly. And, of course, it became longer and longer as medications came in.
So in those training sessions, what were they saying in terms of the kind of scope of the kind of AIDS issue in New Zealand? You know, did they say there were going to be hundreds infected, or what were they saying?
There was a lot of fear that would be very widespread, and of course many felt that it was going to spread into the general community. Most of us in those groups said no, it was unlikely to do that, because gay men tended to keep their sex within the gay community. And so we said, you know, in many ways the gay community is holding that out of the general environment in New Zealand. Whereas in other countries like Scotland, where it was transmitted mainly through drugs, or Africa, the heterosexual stuff, the New Zealand general community was pretty safe. So, there was a fear in our own community, of course, particularly as guys began dying and the number of funerals you went to and so forth.
You were saying that quite a number of the volunteers kind of left after a while just because there weren't that many people.
Yes, it was hard to keep them motivated.
Mm.
And they'd been through the process, they understood it. And we used to say, well, you know, even if they don't stay, they're going to be better members of the community for having done it. And therefore, we weren't too worried about that. Sad perhaps to lose a friendship in the group or whatever, but... So I guess in the end you're left, not left, but you came down to a group of really committed people. And many of those buddied guys right through. And my wife buddied too right through to their deaths.
I've been saying network, and I'm just wondering how extensive was the AIDS support network in New Zealand?
Well, manifestations of it appeared in a number of places. I think Ray had done quite a bit of travelling around, and so had Bruce. And I know there was a group in Christchurch, there was a group in Wellington, there was a group in Hamilton, and there are probably other small groups hither and yon. But they tended to be not as focused or organised as the Auckland group, except perhaps the Christchurch group. Christchurch community is a strange community. There's no cohesion in it at all. There's not much in Auckland, but there's far less in Christchurch. It was at that stage anyway.
And was the network a kind of a government initiative or grassroots initiative?
Oh, it was grassroots. It came entirely from Ray and Bruce. And people like myself and Tony Hughes and Bob Harvey, were strongly in support of that. And the doctor at, Mike Pohl was one of the doctors, the other doctor at Auckland Hospital, what was his name?
Oh, Dr. Ellis Pickler?
Yes. And things like that. And whereas in Wellington they had some horrific situations of guys going to hospital and the way they were treated and so forth. Here in Auckland, we never had that.
What kind of situations?
Well, ambulance people and nurses would be dressed from, you know, head to toe in protective clothing and all that sort of stuff. And whereas in Auckland, they just took the normal cares. And we say, you know, it should be the normal care that you give everybody. If you're not giving that to everybody, you're not doing your job properly. So, and quite a lot of of the nurses at Auckland Hospital were just amazing. And one or two of them came into our network groups and did some training there and part of that.
So when did the government get involved?
Not until the establishment of the AIDS Foundation. That was largely the work, I think, of Tony Hughes, with probably Kate Shepherd. No, Kate, not Shepherd. Kate Leslie. God. And who else was involved? Oh, Bob Harvey was involved in that quite strong as well. Yeah. But Tony, I see him as the St. Paul of Christianity, because Christianity would never have survived without St. Paul. It would have just disappeared. And Paul's and Tony's the same. He's the one that had been there and held things in a way which people listened and respected. And he's done an amazing job. Just superb.
And just explain who Tony Hughes is, because...
Oh, Tony Hughes is the... Well, he was a biomedical researcher, and I'm not sure what his title is now, but he's, I would say probably 2IC of the AIDS Foundation. And he's been there now, 30 years? Perhaps more. And just has done an absolutely tremendous job, very quiet in the background. He's so thorough in his work that people can't question it. If they try, they soon shot down in flames. And it, no histrionics or anything like that, just solid, understanding, skillful. Yeah, the highest respect for him. Mm.
What is the difference between the AIDS Support Network and the AIDS Foundation?
The AIDS Support Network in some ways felt that the foundation came in and took over and pushed... the AIDS Support Network aside, and there was some friction after I left the foundation and Warren took over, and there was some friction between the two, but it died out, and the same with the Gay Line. There was a little bit of antagonism there as well, as though the foundation was taking over and pushing everybody aside. Nobody else mattered. And there was a little bit of that feeling, which was probably true to a certain extent, but, yeah. I mean, the Gay Line, for instance, they staffed the AIDS hotline for years with absolutely no financial support from... AIDS Foundation, even though it was official that they were doing it. That sort of thing. So, yeah, there was a little bit of... But it never got out of hand, I don't think, no. It's just transitioning, you know.
And correct me if I've got it wrong, but am I right in thinking that also, you know, you're going from a very much a volunteer... based approach in terms of support,
yes,
to something like the AIDS Foundation, which was prevention campaigns and...
Yeah, it's, I don't know, there's that. A little later, now when I was director, I haven't a clue now what the salary was. Can't remember. It was less than what I was getting teaching. But later it became quite high, and there was a bit of friction about that. And the staff that were there were quite highly paid. And some volunteers was a little bit of annoyance at that as well. Because looking back, I think the foundation should have drawn the network in as part of the organisation, but they didn't. They shut them out. They took over their premises, took over their phone line, and just as though they didn't exist.
But then you were the first director of the AIDS Foundation.
That was after this.
Oh, so that happened after.
Yeah. And the year that I was there, I mean, looking back now, they didn't really know where they were going. They were very inexperienced, and that came through, yeah.
It must have been quite a it must have been quite a stressful time, in that, you know, mid-80s, you don't know where this is heading. What you see from the US is that numbers of death is just going up, and here you are starting up in this new organisation. What was that like?
That was very clear, and that centred around Tony again. The thing was prevention. There was no cure, so we had to prevent it. The only prevention was the use of condoms. Right from the beginning, that was the message, and put out. And even we did a couple of big posters. I can see them very clearly now. And even in those, we basically said that oral sex was safe, which was way out of line with what everybody else was saying. And that was because Tony said, no, this is a virus and it does not travel that way. And his understanding of it was so accurate. And so right from the beginning there was that sort of, not that everybody believed that, but was certainly there, and said that the only means of transmission was basically anal sex, unprotected anal sex, and apart from blood transfusions and things like that, you know, obvious things. But sexually, that was the only dangerous activity. And they hammered that and hammered that and hammered that, and still do. And it's proved to be true, because even though our figures have recently risen as they have everywhere else in the world, our use of condoms in New Zealand is much higher than anywhere else.
What was it like for you in that kind of mid-80s period, like as the first director of the AIDS Foundation?
I felt I was put into that job willingly, but that no one really knew how to organise it, or what our role, or what my role was. I wasn't really given a clear job description, and nobody else had a clear job description, so everybody was grabbing at parts of the job that they wanted and all that sort of thing. So yes, it wasn't a comfortable experience, and it was nobody's fault. It just, you know, the nature of the beast of a new organisation in an uncertain area.
Another uncertain thing at the time was, of course, homosexual law reform, which is 85, 86.
Yes, yeah.
Did you do anything around law reform?
Apart from talking, I wasn't involved in the so-called movement, because I was too busy with other things, and can't stretch everywhere. And I'm just trying to think who were the front people here in Auckland. Brett Shepherd, certainly, and Tony Katovich behind the scenes. He provided a lot of the money, but as he said to me one day, he said, I left Brett to do the front work. I'm too miserable a bastard to do that.
You've mentioned Brett and Tony a couple of times. Tell me about them.
Well, they owned the Out Empire. Started with the West Side Sauna and the Out magazine, and they had a very large mail order catalogue, and their bookshop and so forth. And I got to know them quite well, because the Gay Line were housed by them in their building in Anzac Avenue. So I got to know them quite well. And Tony's partner, John Kitty, who's died fairly recently. And, yeah, so I presume Tony's still alive, although he should have been dead years ago. He and Brett both contracted cancer, prostate cancer, round about the same time, and Brett didn't do his medications properly and died, and whereas Tony really battled and did everything and still alive. That's, you know, 20 years later. So he's a battler, but he's difficult. He's well known for being very, very difficult. But he won't put up with bullshit of any sort. and very direct, and he'll challenge anybody, government, council, anybody. And he's a hoarder in that he hoards every piece of paper that comes in, every document. And, of course, when it comes to battling, he's got all the documentary evidence. So he won a whole lot of battles. But, yeah, so from that point of view, he was good value.
How did you get involved with Gayline, and what is it?
Gayline was set up when? 1972, I think, as a telephone line that it was set up for guys. They could contact to talk. Set up by a couple of guys who, first of all, put their own home telephone number in the Herald as a place that gay men could contact. And this was, you know, in the early 70s. Incredibly brave, really. It's a wonder the Herald even allowed it. And so it developed from there. And I lived in a number of places after their home. And when I first came to know it, I think I'd done some training for Youthline, again from this encounter movement stuff. And one of the leading persons in it was a member of the staff at Glenview College who I was teaching, and he got me involved, and firstly to help with the training, and then got me to apply to be the manager for there, which I was there for 12 years. So, yeah.
I just want to divert just a smidgen from Gayline just for a minute, and you've just brought back up your secondary school teaching, and what was it like being a gay teacher in the 1980s?
I remember the first day I was there, Rob Grant greeted me, and I'd obviously met him somewhere. I didn't know. I thought, who's this person? And that gradually developed and so forth. And I'm not quite sure the process of becoming known at school. The staff knew. Don't think the first principal I had knew, but the second principal I had was Dave Norris, the Olympic, he was an Olympic athlete and then an Olympic manager. And he was fine. And then the next guy, he was fine with it as well. The board was okay, the staff were okay, but I wasn't out to the students. And Rob Grant was out to the students, but I decided it wasn't appropriate. And I found that boys who are looking at themselves and this, you know, wondering about themselves, or they would come and talk with me rather than talking with Rob, because if they went to talk with Rob, it identified them, whereas if they came and talked to me, it didn't identify them. So it's, it was quite useful, and the work that I was doing, the subjects that I was teaching, it was part of it.
Were you aware of any homophobia or anything like that at school?
Oh, yes, there were some staff who were very anti, but as I said in my farewell speech, although I knew that there were a number of staff, particularly from their Christian point of view, were very anti, but that they'd never shown me anything except respect, that they'd always treated me respectfully, and that was quite something. And I think they respected the work that I was doing with the students, because I was part of the counselling team, although I was doing most of it in the classroom, and in an atmosphere of developing their personality and their self-esteem and all that sort of stuff.
So during your time, did you bring in safe sex, AIDS information?
Absolutely, yeah. Throughout the school.
In what way?
Well, in those classes, it was part of the class. Also, we developed a sexuality education program throughout the school that I trained a number of the staff to lead in, probably about 10 of them, and that was part of the curriculum of it, HIV, AIDS, safe sex, as well as all the other stuff. Mm. Yeah, it was very, very clear. We had a few parents who objected. Very few, actually. I think only about 3 in the whole 12 years I was doing it, or more, 20 years I was doing it, yeah. So it was very few. And students had the option of opting out, but most students didn't tell their parents, because otherwise they knew their parents would want to take them out, and they didn't tell them. But for some years we had parent meetings and put the curriculum before them, and 3 or 4 years, and there was never any objection. They all supported, and the number who attend became less and less. So we didn't take, we discontinued them. Legally, it was required to begin with, but it soon disappeared.
Heading back to Gayline and your involvement. So what did your involvement entail? What did you do?
Everything. I was employed for 20 hours a week, and I did about 60. And I did everything. I ran the office. I staffed. I trained the volunteers. I staffed the AIDS hotline and Gayline through the day, from 10 till 5. Cleaned the toilets. Everything, yeah. I was the only one there. I did have some help at various times. I got involved with the courts, and particularly through one or two lawyers and police officers who were concerned about people being entrapped for sexual activity, and getting them either diversion if possible, or community service rather than anything else. And quite a number of them came and did their community service at Gayline. And also with WINS, and they would come and work there for 6 months or something. So those sorts of things in order to get some sort of help.
You say entrapment. So what kind of year is that, and what kind of entrapment are we talking about?
Particularly in the toilets, but not just. I remember one guy who came to me and was sent to me by a police officer at the court. He had appeared in court and then was remanded and so forth, and he sent to me. And he'd been walking along the coastal walkway, and this guy was walking behind him, and sort of came alongside and were talking, and the guy suggested they go to the bushes, and as soon as this a man touched this guy, turned out to be a police officer, and arrested him. That sort of thing. And also, of course, in the toilets. There was lots of that in the toilets. It was very unsafe.
What kind of year are we talking?
I suppose from the late 70s, early 80s, even after homosexual reform was still going on today in some cases. There are some police officers who, for usually religious beliefs, think that that's what they've got to do.
How many volunteers did Gayline have in the early 90s?
We probably never had less than 30, and it could be up to 60. But the attrition rate was quite high, and so you had to continually train new ones. And the attrition rate was very, very seldom because of negativity. It was quite a change of life circumstances, moving away, change of job, getting married, whatever. So, yeah, the attrition rate was quite high. But we never had any real difficulty getting volunteers. You know, lots of the other... I was on the Community Organisation Grant Scheme Committee, the COGS, and they said, oh, it's so difficult to get volunteers. How is it that you get them so easily? And I used to say, well, you know, our people are committed to their cause. But the real reason was because our volunteers worked in the evening, whereas theirs were through the day. And it was very difficult to get volunteers through the day. So it was, we were lucky from that point of view. Well, not lucky, but the circumstances were good.
And what kind of training did they get?
Again, I used the same sort of training. The encounter movement, you know, is still very strong in me, and that sort of stuff on a personal level, but also a lot of work on communication, particularly telephone communication, which is quite different from ordinary communication. And people will tell you more in 10 minutes on the phone than they'll tell you in 2 days face to face. It's just, they just, it's all there in the most embarrassing details. And it didn't matter whether they're straight or gay or anything, it was the same. Because they had the security of being anonymous. And we made sure that people knew that we did not have a caller ID service or anything like that. And knowledge about HIV, about sexual infections, and about general the gay community and what was available. You had a very good database of what was available in the community.
Because I'm guessing at that time the internet would have been like in its infancy. I mean, yes. If you had the internet.
Mm. I think that side of it, the personal communication side is not there though. And they still want to talk to somebody. And often the asking of a question about something innocent, as it were, was really a testing thing to see, can I go further and really open up? And so that those sorts of skills have helped. For instance, I said, you know, the only starting words you should use are the WH words, where, how, what, when, which, but never why. Because as soon as you ask why do you think that, or why do you do that, the person becomes offensive because they think that you're trying to force them to justify themselves. So that, and you never use should or ought, and so on. Or I think you should do this. So it was non-directive counselling, totally listening and guiding the listening so that it allowed them to explore the situation themselves and come to their own answers, and which they'd be much more likely to put into practice any that we gave them. I mean, we'd give them information if they wanted it, but their own personal answers were theirs. Mm. So those were the skills that they learned, and the skills I wish everybody could learn. Mm.
Over your time with Gayline, did you notice that the calls changed, you know, either the type of people or the type of questions?
Not really. And the coming out process is still the same for as it's always been. Hard for some, easier for others. So I don't think much has changed in that. Yeah.
When you look at your own personal journey, how would you sum it up? Has it been hard or is it easy? Is it?
It's mixed, very mixed. Yeah, there have been some bad patches and there have been... But I've never, ever been confronted with strongly negative attitudes or actions or anything that's frightening or anything like that. I've never found myself rejected because of it. Maybe some have just quietly gone away and left me alone, but that's fine. But I've never been aware of anyone ceasing their relationship with me because of it. And certainly not in my own family. So from that point of view, mine has been painful in many times, but reasonably okay, reasonably smooth. Mm. And you know, I look at young people today, many of them, and they're out from a very early age and enjoying their support and mostly with support from their families. Not entirely, but mostly. Mm. You still get those odd occasions.
Moving into the 2000s and 2004, 2005, we get civil unions in New Zealand, the ability to have a civil union, and you became a celebrant.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I'd been a marriage celebrant anyway in the church, and I thought, well, this is something I could do, and I'd like to do it, and it could be fun. And I believed in the process. I thought, you know, we should grab it with both hands, and even if it wasn't perfect, it was at least a step in the right direction. And so, yeah, I just did that because it wasn't very difficult because I'd been registered as a marriage celebrant anyway, although I'd given that up when I left the church. And so it was, I knew all about it, and it wasn't a big step to do.
And you say move in the right direction. What does that mean?
Well, that I thought civil union was a bit of a cop out in some ways, but I could see that, you know, if we didn't take that, we weren't going to get any further at that stage. Although, of course, going back further as far as the age of consent was concerned, we actually the community actually sabotaged that because the proposed bill didn't include equality of age.
This is going back before the Framwile bill?
Oh, yes.
So this was...
There were two attempts. Mm. One by Vern, who's an MP from somewhere in Taranaki, I think.
Albin Young.
Yeah. And also the one by...
was that the Freer?
Oh, Warren Freer, yes, yes. I think Martin Finney was involved in that somewhere as well. Mm. And neither of those included the age of consent. And so the community more or less withdrew its support from them, and so they fell by the wayside. And it was only when Fransbill came in with the age of consent being equal. And even then, a lot in our community didn't want that because they thought they'd never get it. It would stymie the thing altogether.
So with civil unions, was the same thing happening where people were saying, well, actually, this is not equality, we...
Exactly.
Don't really want this.
Yeah, and a lot of the women particularly were very strong about that. But when you looked at the detail, it gave us nearly everything that marriage gave us. And the only major thing was the adoption thing.
Mm. And the name, marriage.
And the name, of course, yeah. I couldn't care less about the name. it's interesting because... You know, the church is a fort. Marriage has never been a church. It's a government law. If the church wants it their way, they can do it for their people, that's fine. But not to impose it on everyone else. And so marriage has always been a legal thing. Right through the ages, it's been a legal thing. For hundreds of years. So it's a legal thing we have to change. We won't change the churches, particularly, any more than Muslim faith. They've still got 100 years to catch up on us. they'll get there eventually.
So we're here in February 2013, and the Whistle Wall Bill has passed its first reading in Parliament, gone to Select Committee. They haven't quite yet reported back, and I'm thinking, what do you think the chances are of this a marriage equality bill going through?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that it will go through with quite a good majority. I think the time is right, and it will. I'm not quite sure where the question of adoption stands, because there's also the bill that is at Marion Street is doing about adoption. And I think it's on the back burner at the moment because Lewisa is saying that, you know, if her bill goes through, it includes adoption. It's all the rights and privileges of marriage. And adoption is one of those rights and privileges. And I mean, they're gay men in New Zealand who have adopted children. It's stupid because a single gay man can adopt a child, but a couple can't. If one has children, his partner can adopt those children. But it's so mixed up, it's crazy. And it's unfair on the kids. Mm. They should be given clear, equal status to anyone else.
How were your kids when you came out?
Well, they were in their late teens. The girls were fine. They both said independently, you know, so what, we've known for years. The boys hadn't a clue. They took a little while longer to, particularly my older son, to come to terms with that. And now, I mean, they're just as likely to throw cheek at me about it as anyone else. I think I told you that when I got my Queen's Service Medal, one of my sons said, oh, how appropriate. So, you know, that sort of thing, yeah.
Now, that was 2005, the Queen's Service Medal?
It sort of was based on the HIV thing, because that was what was acceptable for the government to give. But the community aspect was included as well. Yeah, it was quite interesting how it was done. And I still don't know who was responsible. I presume it was Chris Carter, but I haven't a clue. But, yeah, that was pretty awesome, really. And the investiture was a very interesting experience with Dame Sylvia. Lovely lady, yeah. Yeah. So it's, yeah, it was good to get that and feel that not just me but the community had some recognition like that. Because I don't think there was then anyone else who had been QSM for that. I think Warren before, or maybe Warren. Yeah.
It must be quite something to be tapped on the shoulder.
Oh, absolutely. I was totally taken by surprise, yeah. I mean, a few things like that that have really taken me, a couple of people, man and woman, turned up at the office one day and they said they were from the Aronga Trust or something, and they said, we want to give you a recognition for your work. They said, this is a financial recognition for you, not for the organisation. It's for you personally. A cheque of $3,000. Things like that have happened, which I just think, oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Oh, one thing we haven't touched on that has actually been a part of your life for decades, you know, going right back to the 80s, is the Fifth Season Gardening Group.
Yeah.
Mm. Tell me about that.
Trying to think today how I got involved in that. No, it was when I was with my partner Peter, and I think it was because we were both gardeners. Our garden was twice or three times in the heroic garden thing, but before that we'd been on the committee of the Fifth Season Garden Group, and the main functions or the main things that does are monthly visits to gardens, usually a group of two or three gardens, usually gay gardens, but not necessarily so. And then we had a couple of functions a year, a Christmas function and a midwinter function, and that's sort of the program. And it's been also on the edge of the heroic garden thing, and sometimes been involved with, sometimes just supportive. And it's always been a bit unclear where the Heroic Gardens fits in between GABA and the Fifth Season, but it's really an ad hoc committee that exists year by year, maybe.
What do you get out of gardening?
Oh, it's gardening is... I think it's a very spiritual thing, and it allows you to completely forget about everything in the world and just dealing with what's there and the growth and the change and the beauty and all that sort of thing. It's I find it very renewing. And if I often I will go out and I'll sort of, weed there, and I'll pull it out before I know it's 6 hours later. And I've totally forgotten everything. Yeah. Often things that I shouldn't have forgotten. But it's totally absorbing. Healing, very healing.